serve on the board of the Cleveland Project, and I was part of this year's planning committee. And when I heard about this particular workshop, I thought it's very interesting to me what folks who do philosophy and theology have to say about local craft. So Greg Clark is a professor of philosophy at North Park University here in Chicago. And Tyler DeLong is a doctoral student at the University of Dayton, Ohio. And Dan McClain is a professor at Loyola University in Maryland, and will be sharing with us about local craft and how that intersects not only with creation care and anthropology, but also with moral and spiritual change. So,
and we have until how?
We have until noon.
Okay. So,
well,
do you guys want to go with the arrangement we talked about yesterday?
And that was the arrangement.
That was the arrangement.
Let's stick with it. Are you feeling discombobulated?
No, I'm not. Okay. Well, Tyler was supposed to get cups so we could drink.
I know.
Beer.
So I know.
But
there's just 10 mugs, right?
Right. Yeah.
You know,
I just think we can be
traveling with glass on the airplane is always really difficult. But then also bringing serving vessels is impossible too. All right, we'll just cross that bridge when we get there. Well, welcome, everyone. So we're going to talk about local craft, which one way of thinking immediately about local craft, so that this is not just a term of art or a jargony term, is we're really just thinking about do-it-yourself, DIY. So in some ways, this is a discussion, and I really do hope it's going to be a discussion. We all sort of genuinely hope that, because I don't know how scripted we are today. I'm not super scripted. What I'm going to do, actually, I'm going to pass some things around. Feel free to open them up, smell them, touch them. They're going to be Tyler's after this anyway, so it's cool if they get dirty.
Yeah.
And I'll introduce these in a moment. Feel free to smell them and touch them and be tactile. So we want to have a discussion today about the theology of DIY, if you will. But in a lot of ways, what we're doing is not so much just touting the virtues of do-it-yourself, right? There's this, and I'll try to stay on target today, but there's a website called The Art of Manliness. Maybe some of you have seen this, right? I kind of look like a poster child for this website. And I'm not intentionally. And in fact, I want to say that we're not here to sort of to tout that, but what I want to talk about more is how bringing people into a community of craft is in fact that it's a community organizing or community building activity, and why would that be important at the conference that we're at right now? I mean, so much of what we're hearing is, you know, kind of the apocalyptic note of our ecological situation, right? It's deeply eschatological, and there's a kind of fever pitch to the talks that we're hearing. And I don't want to dull that edge at all. But one of the things that's always going through my mind when I hear that, right? And I assume that the majority of us in the room are probably we're probably open to that message if we didn't already come sort of convinced of that message. We're not allergic to it. We wouldn't be here, right? So there's something of a preaching to the choir here, at least the rhetorical angle. Our speakers probably don't have to work that hard. But when we go back to our communities, we don't enjoy that luxury, right? I'm probably one of the most liberal Episcopalian parishes in Baltimore, and I really struggle with getting our Creation Cares Commission to put screws to our hospitality hour to use ceramic mugs and not styrofoam cups. You know, here I'm grasping Tyler and styrofoam cups. The irony. But I want to go back, and I'll have willing ears, but I won't have willing hearts and active minds. I need to really focus on the rhetorical angle of all that we're discussing here today. I need people to willingly jump in and lend a hand. One of the ways I think you can do that is by creating communities of craft, communities of DIY in your parishes. And I have a fair amount of experience of creating these communities, not in parishes, but with, you know, the master students in my program, with baristas at my local coffee shop, with people in my neighborhood. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about my experience with DIY as community organizing. I'm going to talk about why I think that's important. I'm going to try and answer three questions real quickly here. What is it that we're talking about today? Why is it important? And what's been my experience? And all three of us are going to attempt to do it in that format. And then we want to open it up to you all for a much longer conversation, hopefully, than our presentations. We'll see if we're successful with that. About how do you all do this already, and how can you do it in the future? So the underlying conviction that I have is an anthropological one, or a theological anthropology. And that is that there's something deeply pragmatic in our humanity. We make things. And when we don't make things, there's something in us that's unfulfilled. For the last 8 years, I've been in a PhD program, two of which I was working full-time. I'm at a desk. I'm in front of a computer screen. I'm living up here. Most of my life, and now my income, is up here. I should wear a bike. So I often feel really unfulfilled when it comes to tactile experience. And so several years ago, I began working on my own bike. I actually acquired a bike on Craigslist, and I learned how to rebuild it from the ground up. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. But that's the kind of craft that I'm talking about. Like I already mentioned, you know, there's these kind of DIY websites. There's the Instructables website. That's probably one of the most popular. Many of you have probably seen it. I get the Instructables email every day. I never do the projects, but it's fun watching them. There's a lot of, like, kind of hippie cult zines, like the Taproot zine. My wife used to get that one. So culture of craft, right? This culture of craft has acquired like a really kind of sexy sheen lately. But from what I can tell, it's still mostly a spectator sport, right? Most people's experience with DIY is at the level of hobby, and it doesn't actually make much of a practical difference to the way that they live, right? And largely, I'm not. I think that's good, right? It's a lot of these things are kind of gateway drugs to then waking people up to this possibility that you can do a lot of these things for yourself. But when I try to convince my family and friends to build their own bikes, to pour their own coffee, to come over to my house, use my equipment, use my expertise, build your own bike, the first question that folks almost inevitably ask me is, how much will it cost? How much time will it take? Is it worth the expense, right? So dollar bill, y'all. That's the bottom line, is still money. It's money and it's time. So in contrast to this bottom-line approach, I want to share with you my own experiences in DIY, and I want to think about why local craft can be an instrumental means towards formation and virtue, and perhaps even discipleship. So my first argument is that local craft, you know, what we're calling local craft, is a social communal thing, that inevitably it will connect you to people. Secondly, it reshapes the way you think about consumables, and by extension, it reshapes the way you think about the impact that consumables have on your community or your watershed, your place. In fact, craft places and situates you in ways that you would never expect. So I already mentioned bike building. I needed to get to my school. I needed to get to the commuter train. I needed a bike. We couldn't afford a second car. And my scooter is like kind of always on the fritz. I have this vintage Vespa, and it's more of a hassle to maintain than it's worth. And so I just wanted a bike. So I got this really janky Sears Torpedo 3-speed, and eventually the rims kind of went on it. And so I started investigating, like, getting new rims for it. And bike shops would just look at me like, why would you invest money in this thing? But I continued to do that. I continued to invest time and money because it was doing something for me, something I couldn't name at the time. And at a local coffee shop, which is where most of my life happens, a neighbor I had never met saw my bike and kind of really liked it. I had cork grips, and I had used twine in some sort of creative ways on it. But he really liked what I had done with the wheels. And he invited me over to his house. And this guy's name is Garrett. Going to Garrett's basement was like a trip through steel framed history. He must have like 50 frames in various states of repair hanging all over his garage. And he's only a few years older than me. I recognize him very old. conversations with people like Garrett and folks online about doing it yourself opened me up to the fact that there's a tradition here of bike maintenance, a tradition of bike building and bike maintenance, a tradition that I wasn't aware of, right? Doing it myself was pretty much a solipsistic thing, right? I didn't understand standards. I didn't really understand what I was doing when I was wrenching on my bike. And most of the time, you know, they were kind of failed experiments. But working with people like Garrett helped me develop an appreciation for the subtlety and the difficulty that goes into bike maintenance. And so that was my first real experience with a community of craft and a tradition that stands behind that community. But those of you that are familiar with work developed, Alistair McIntyre, already probably hearing some of that language of tradition of skill. After working with Garrett for a while, and he eventually gave me an old 80s frame, the thing got destroyed in a car crash, and then I acquired another one, and it becomes really addictive. I started building bikes for others. I had all these parts laying around the house. I had started to acquire tools, and I started to spread the gospel of building your own bike and getting around town on a means of transportation that you built for yourself. And by the end of a couple of years of doing this, there would be nights where I'd have five or six people, some spectators, some actually working on the bike in my basement, which those of you who know Greg Boyles, Greg has been coming here longer than me. This was Greg's bedroom, my basement. And Greg, of course, would be talking to people about Wendell Berry, and I'd be working on bikes. But we have this community assembled down in my basement, and sometimes we were giving old parts away, sometimes we were helping people sort of envision a bicycle from a 70s or 80s steel frame. But it was really about, some of it was about conservancy, right? You could use a used frame, and you could find other used parts, and you could put together a perfectly acceptable bike. And sometimes it was about envisioning something new. I get a lot of pleasure out of seeing those bikes on the road today. And here's a really salient example. One of the baristas, the local baristas, Angela, needed a bike. She was riding around on this really small bike, and it was way too small for her. And so I got her a bike. Actually, I think I forgot. I wanted to bring a picture. But Angela's bike got stolen one night while she was working at a restaurant. And we all kind of mourned it. Facebook pictures went up everywhere. And everybody knew this bike, and it just fell off the grid. About 2 months later, I get a call from somebody. He says, "Dan, did you build up this white Step 3 with red handles?" I said, "Yeah, that's one of the bikes that I built." And I kind of have this like trademark style in my neighborhood, you know? People recognize the bikes that I've worked on. And he goes, "Well, it's at the corner of Maryland right now at the convenience store." So Greg and I hopped on our bikes and we rode over, and sure enough, down the street, there's these young kids fooling around on the bike, and they've mangled it badly, and the derailleur's hanging off the back. The derailleur had snapped right off the frame. But there's the bike. You know, and so we, through some negotiations, and then eventually the cops showed up. Greg and I are walking home with the bike, and we fixed it up, and we put Angela back on it. And to this day, I can still go to D.C. to that block and see her bike parked at one of the bike racks in front of the restaurant that she worked at. I get a lot of pleasure out of that. So I have dozens of stories like this. I'm not trying to charm you into this. I realize that to some people this might sound cliche, and to some people this might sound extravagant. Anybody who knows the kind of time and money that goes into making a bike work might think that's very extravagant. But those of you who commute by bike know that it's not sexy. It's not extravagant. In fact, it's risky. If your bike malfunctions and you're late to work, it can be a problem. If your bike breaks down and you don't have a spare bike, you're crippled. If you're not independently wealthy, and I'm not, bike maintenance is costly. If you rush your bike maintenance, you can do it wrong, and it sets you back. I'm often frustrated by my own incompetence, my ignorance, and my intemperance. And here's where the virtue part comes in. DIY, or these kinds of craft things, especially if I'm working on somebody else's project, It forces me to confront my lack of virtue. If I want my project to be better, I myself must be better. If I encounter a problem outside of my skill set or beyond my skill level, I have to reach out for help. I have to encounter the community and the tradition. I have to submit to standards that are not my own making. I have to accept that there's a right way or right ways of doing things and wrong ways of doing things. I not only have to be social, I have to submit to someone's authority. I have to acknowledge my own vulnerability and my need for another or the other. So here, the formative and social aspects of DIY, or just of craft, any kind of skill, actually, or any kind of practice, really, the formative and social aspects are irreplaceable. Right? And you can be the most introverted person, and I acknowledge that I'm not, but you can be a hermit, but there are still standards. And you might have to discover them yourself, or you might read about them in a bike manual or whatever, but you have to submit to an authority that's not your own. Finally, doing this shapes the material imagination. And what I mean by the material imagination is the kinds of possibilities that you envision with your stuff. If you don't have a car, as I didn't until just last week, and you want to take your four-year-old to the beach because that's where he wants to go for his birthday, you have a different set of possibilities than somebody who does own a car. That's the material imagination. But it goes deeper than that. That's kind of a superficial example. Although, you know, superficial examples tend to be the most poignant for people with young children. I want to reemphasize that in producing for myself and others, I think I'm beginning to think about production and consumption differently. Bike building was only the beginning. I already mentioned my scooter that I try to maintain. I brew my own beer, which I would love to serve for you all. I brought a very sort of high-octane beer that I was hoping I could give everybody a sip of. And maybe we can still do that. I make kefir or kefir, I don't know how you pronounce it. I make applesauce, my own veggies. And what you all were smelling was soap. I recently discovered the fun of soap making. Right? That's a live burn. Anybody who's ever seen Fight Club knows what I'm talking about. I didn't do it on purpose. right? I didn't want to confront pain. I bumped the edge of the kettle. And then I also make beard balm and lotions and stuff. What I'm trying to do is not be cute. I have like a list of consumables and I'm trying to tick off the list. I want to get off the grid, the capitalist consumeristic grid. I recognize I still have to buy materials from somebody. I can't make my own lye. I guess I could actually boil my own ash and try to make my own lye. But some of these things I don't have time for. But I do have time to invest in the process of production. And it's that process of production that's beginning to reshape my imagination. And I think Greg's going to talk a little bit about this really wonderful book, Shop Class of Soulcraft, and I've actually omitted my bit on it because I think you're going to say something about it, and I think it's going to be good. But things like taking a lot of time, developing attention, attentiveness. We don't think of attentiveness as a virtue, but it is. Right, being careful, being thoughtful. These are all essential to the development of virtue, but they're also essential to producing things. And it's in becoming virtuous that we become more human. This is Crawford's thesis. I take it as one of his theses, and so I'll leave that to Greg. But it's that process of becoming more human, becoming more virtuous. And as we draw others into it and we begin to help them reshape their imaginations, I think we've taken a pretty big step in the rhetoric of bringing people around to the conversation that we're having here today. Right? And so think about craft or skill and practice as discipleship in the sense that you open people's eyes up to possibilities and to consequences that they hitherto were not aware of. And I'll leave it there. I think I probably didn't.
Bless you.
So, thinking about work, thinking about communities, a helpful place to start is within the Christian community. So, kind of the pinnacle act of the Christian community in prayer, at least for many of our communities, is the Eucharist. you have this time, the preparation, in which the leader says, fruit of the earth, work of human hands, this becomes for us a fruit of the earth, the bread of life. And what's interesting, I think, in that is that's a radically participatory theology of work. That human action becomes wrapped up in this divine narrative of salvation in the world. That which we are dependent upon for our sustenance, for our life, as Jesus said, we don't live on bread alone. Ironically, we participate in bringing that to God through our work. Bread is not an individual thing. My craft story, I think, begins with making bread. It was I had a friend who came over for a beer. We made bagels. I remember being so frustrated with all of the nasty bread all over my hands. Like, I couldn't get it off. You wash it with soap and it just gets slimier, you know? But there was something in that action of making those bagels that night, probably 7 or 8 years ago, that radically, radically changed my life. In the messiness of that, you get this great transformation. It's not something that can be done individually. So you have wheat, you have farmers that go out, you have families that go out into the field and plant the seeds and harvest the seeds. So work is inherently, at least in the Eucharist, work is inherently communal. You can't have bread by yourself. But what's also very interesting about bread, even on a material level, you're participating in creation because I can't get the bread to rise on my own. I can't get the wine to ferment. I actually have to rely on that which is not my work. So even at the material level, regardless of our theologies of the Eucharist and what takes place in those moments, I come from a Catholic community. But in those material moments, something is taking place in that bread that is actually dependent upon me. I participate in it, but I am also equally dependent upon the action of yeast. These live agents that kind of are all around us. The same with wine. Grapes are crushed into juice. Well, they can stay juice, but they won't stay juice without our preserving them as juice, because something actively present in the world, doing things in the world, actually creates it as wine. And we bring that gift together. But also in that, using Eucharistic imagery, I hope none of us celebrate the Eucharist by ourselves. None of us go to our rooms and try to do that action ourselves, because we can't do that ourselves. It requires a body. It requires a people gathered together. So work in a Eucharistic mindset is inherently communal in that sense too, so that the actions that we do, the work of making the bread, making the wine, the fermentation, our participation in creation to create these gifts that are offered to God, are actually offered only in community with each other. We cannot do that alone. So inherently our work binds us in community. It reminds us that we cannot do things alone. We can't offer the gifts of God back to God by ourselves. We have to do it in community. I think that's one of the most important things as we're at this conference talking about how do we counter the apocalyptic vision that we're seeing right now. I venture to suggest that that's we've created this by trying to distinguish ourselves as individuals and kind of offer that back to God. We can't do that. We need work to show us. We need the fruit of the earth and the work of human hands to show us that actually we can't do it by ourselves. we can't do it without creation, because without creation, without God's presence and figuring out all the intricacies of creation, our bread doesn't rise and our wine doesn't ferment. And that we can't celebrate that gift without each other. On a more practical side, I've been involved with a couple intentional communities, most of the time which are very miserable and messy. If you ever hear anybody talking about a community that isn't miserable, they're fairly new to it. So, one thing that has marked that that we've been really blessed in our communities, or one particular community, is that we do things together, or at least we have this idea that we're going to try to do things together. Our community has a lot of children right now, so that's not as present as we would like either. But you know, we have our workshops that we try to get together and build things with each other. We try to help each other out. At the beginning, very, very romantic stages of our community, we all lived in one house, and we would gather together in the living room and try to make our own clothes or mend the ones that we have, creating food together, doing those common practices that are very Eucharistic, and that we're doing these things together. It's through that common practice of working and failing together that actually teaches us what work is, how hard it is. Planting a garden is not easy, and it's not sexy. Kind of the most recent thing. So I've done a few different things. Food is an important part of my life, gardening, being part of some urban farms. But also woodworking has kind of become an object of my desire. I really like working with wood. I'm intrigued by trees. But a part of that that's really important to me is that it takes on very functional. So that the aesthetic, the beauty of the woodworking is actually very functional aesthetic. Mm-hmm. I haven't made any really beautiful chessboards. I think that would be really great, but I haven't gotten there. And I'm okay with that. But what I've tried to do, and I haven't done this alone, I've been highly dependent on people to teach me, is learning to... So my wife and I, we bought a house in a neighborhood, really run down. The house was an abandoned drug house. And it was in miserable disrepair. And I tried to completely remodel it in about 2 months. Actually, when I was at a Ecclesia project last year, I was taking like a 3-day break from that. And I had to learn. So we ripped out everything. There was black mold. There was no plumbing. The gas line was all messed up. And I had to learn to do that. I had to learn to take out walls and rebuild them, to rebuild the kitchen, to do plumbing, to run a gas line. That's the most terrifying thing I've ever done. I have 3 beautiful children and a wonderful wife that I would like to be safe. So running a gas line, that was the last thing I did. But in that process, like, not only was it hard and I made lots of mistakes, I'm horrible at drywall work, especially ceiling drywall. So if anybody's really good wants to take it to a trip. But I was reliant on other people, and I was reliant, but also I had to remain in a posture of learning. I had to be taught. I had to have somebody show me how to run plumbing. I was dependent on somebody. I'm also in the world of academia, for better or for worse. And we get this idea that we know everything, and that we can conquer any task, and we can figure it out. Well, remodeling that house showed me that a certain amount of this. So that was a very profound experience. So then my final one is kind of coming back to something that's very interesting to me when I focus on maybe academically, is finding ourselves as a people shaped by the landscape. And that's something that I need to reiterate from Ted Myers' talk. So not only do we build things with our hands because it's inherent in our humanness to create, because we're created in the image of God that creates, but that also I run into some serious problem that I have to go to Lowe's to buy cheap pine. That's a problem for me, because a lot of my work and a lot of my heart and my faith is wrapped up in preserving those indigenous places. But I'm kind of stuck in a structure that says that I have to go to these places to get wood. Mm-hmm. Whether I'm too lazy to find other avenues, or I'm too broke, or whatever, that's what I have had to do. So something that I've been trying to work out, and it's been present, but I'm trying to really focus on it more, is actually finding materials, creating with what is around me. We all have, hopefully we all have some trees around us somewhere. Tree drop limbs. Finding ways of implementing those natural resources that aren't natural resources around us because we participate with them in creating things. Another really great option that I confess I has not been as much a part of my life as I had in the past is there's really great, people throw away really incredible things. You can find I found some of the most beautiful pieces of wood in dumpsters. Mm-hmm. So that Christian practice, our work actually becomes redemptive in that way too. We're taking the refuse of our capitalist system and we're recreating it. Mm-hmm. We're participating with God and taking our castaways, and it's very redemptive. It's very incarnational and high of its resurrection.
It's like the woodie song.
Yeah, right. The street. I was going to bring in piles of wood as an illustration. There's a dumpster right up there. It's full of wood.
Good wood.
Very good wood. But we live in a system that where would they take that? So they throw it away. They throw landfills. Really horrible cycle. So I'll leave it there.
Okay. Thank you. So my name's Greg. These guys have done a really nice job of covering especially the theology of craft. So I don't know where I'm going to go, but
I'm going to start by giving you some things to hold on to. So I make bows. That's my craft. So I'll pass these around. You can pull the string back, but especially if you're bigger, don't pull it past your nose. And don't let the string go, because you could break the bow. And there are physics reasons for that. We could talk about it if you want. So I'll start this in back. I think at one level what this workshop is about is disengaging from an industrial capitalist economy and delivery systems. And at least since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, that's what craft has kind of always been about. There have been there's an arts and crafts movement, right? And they were trying to disengage from the Industrial Revolution. So, the amazing thing is the Industrial Revolution kind of incorporates everything into it, doesn't it? So, it turns out the arts and craft movement is primarily for wealthier people. It got appropriated by precisely the economy that it was supposed to resist. So I want to be aware of that. I want to be aware that the craft movement might not actually be an alternative to the industrial economy. It might actually be an example of the industrial economy and get absorbed by the industrial economy. And that's kind of problematic. The craft movement has not succeeded in creating an alternative economy. In fact, it's pretty, there's a lot of money spent on crafts. Mm-hmm. The kind of the interesting thing is it's not mostly spent on the materials, it's spent on the books. Mm-hmm. People read about crafts a lot more than they actually do them.
Same with kindergarten. The talk to action ratio is a little out of balance.
Exactly, I think, and that's true whether you're talking about knitting or bow building or what have you. And so, this is kind of the elephant in the room, maybe, that's kind of staring at us and saying, it's like you might think you can provide an alternative, but there's what's the Borg?
You will be assimilated.
It's the Borg. So I'm passing around three bows. So, but I do think craft. Before I do that, The other thing to say is we can really easily be made fun of. I teach a class kind of on craft. Anyway, this is a book that's actually been published. It's a wonderful book, How to Sharpen Pencils, a Practical and Theoretical Treatise on the Artisanal Craft of Pencil Sharpening. So, you know, everything that we're doing can be, you can laugh at it through sort of reducing it to its trivialities. So that said, I still don't those, right? To just stop there is like, well, there's no, you can't escape the board, right? So why even try? We're just going to sit back, right? But I, you know, I'm not going to sit back. So this is my teacher. When I was maybe 10 years ago, one of my sons said to me, "Dad, build me a bow." I said, "I can't build a bow. What are you asking me to do?" But I had a bow when I was a little kid, so I asked my mom, "Do you still have that old bow?" So she still had that old bow. And so I gave it to my son. And then I started teaching it, and I thought, oh, hey, this is kind of fun. But it was a bow I had when I was a kid, and I thought, well, I'll get something off eBay. So I got the cheapest bow I could find on eBay. It was made out of wood. So I shot that for a little while, and then I started looking at it, and I thought, you know, I think I could do this. And so, you know, one of the things I would say about craft is you don't start big. You know, you don't have to do everything at once. You have to do something. And the craft will create its own syllabus. It'll create its own itinerary. And you'll learn things as you need to learn them. I should probably. So I could talk specifically about building bows. Maybe that's the main thing I want to say, is that just do it. Do something. As you do something, you'll learn more. And that will spread out in all sorts of different directions. So I can say a little bit about the bows I'm passing around. So let's see, that's my oldest bow. I've taken a deer with that bow. It's a pretty heavy bow if you try to pull it back. It's got a bamboo back. It's the main bow, the wood is Osage orange, which is considered, along with yew, maybe to be the best wood for making a bow. When you're thinking about wood for bow building, it's a lot different than, say, what you're looking for in a tuba for. You know, what you're saying about pine, it's like, I think it's absolutely amazing you can buy a tuba for the price of a greeting card.
Right.
Somehow that just ain't right.
Yeah.
And yet, but it's true. You can buy a tuba for the price of a greeting card. So, cheaper than a greeting card, right? So either greeting cards are too high, or we're doing something. Pine doesn't make good bow wood. But what you're looking for in wood and a bow is you're looking for a bow that can take tension, because you've got tension here, and can take compression, because you're going to have compression here. Right? So that's a laminated bow. Bamboo is really good in both tension and compression. You know, the reason why you can't let the bow go with these bows is because there aren't artificial materials in them. There's not fiberglass or something like that. You know, fiberglass is an amazing material. Bamboo is the closest we can get to sort of natural fiberglass. But all of their woods will just the way they're built. So that's my oldest bow. That one is I made for a friend. Some of you might know Andy Ross, who that's his bow, actually. He went to Kenya, and he brought me back a bow from Kenya, and I gave him that bow. So that's Andy's bow. And it's got it has no back on it, but it does have a rattlesnake skin on the back. And it's also Osage orange, although I painted it with a black leather dye. So. And this is actually a maple sapling. This is my most recent bow. It's got knots and holes. And this one took the most skill to make. And actually, it's the one I kind of, don't know, I shouldn't have favorites for those. But, you know, because it's, actually Monica saw this, this is the one I had at the Covenant Point last year, and so this is what kind of completed bill looks like, so. He wanted me to say a little bit about, now I'll pass this around to you if you want to scan.
I think that's what I'm going to say about bow building. Oh, no. I want to say a couple other things. So there are a couple things about building a bow.
One of the things that it's taught me is it's taught me about wood. Another thing that I learned as I build bows is that every culture in the world has invented the bow and arrow. It's, you know, Japanese culture, Mongolian culture, Hungarian culture, Scandinavian culture, all Native American cultures. Now, there could be thousands of years between these times. So, but I think when you're talking about craft, very often you'll be talking about something that many cultures across the world have participated in. And you get a kind of segue into other cultures if you find other cultures that are into your craft. One of the stories that Matthew Crawford tells, he was an electrician, and he tells about traveling in India and seeing electricians doing their job and suddenly realizing he's got something in common with these electricians in India. I think that's going to be true for any craft, for beer brewing or bow making or what have you, and so that there's something important there about connecting to other humans in community through your craft. In the case of bow building, one of the other things that it does is it because I hunt. So a bow is a technology that mediates your relationship to the environment, but it also limits your relationship to the environment. You know, this is not a gun. It's not a rifle. It's not even a compound bow, and it's not a it's not a recurve either.
Crossbow.
I can barely say the name. It's not a crossbow, right? So, you know, for me to hunt a deer, I have to get basically within about 25 yards of that deer. That turns out to be kind of hard, right? But it teaches me that I've got to learn a lot about. It teaches me that I have to learn the landscape that I'm on. I need to learn the habits of the deer. And I need to be able to imagine what it would be like to be a deer to roam through this landscape. So it gives me a different relationship. So, you know, so I'm imagining what it would be like to be the animal that I'm trying to kill. I don't really want to talk about hunting as a craft, although hunting is a craft. It's a thing I think that most of us as city dwellers don't know how to think about anymore. There's a big thing on Facebook recently about a cheerleader posting pictures of hunts she had been on. And everybody kind of screamed bloody murder. I'm thinking about Chev's stuff. A bow is standard operating equipment in a pre-agricultural society or a non-agricultural society. It's a standard way that you would make your way through the landscape. It was it's a standard tool. It's just, you know, it's your smartphone. It's your it's the way you're going to relate to things. And actually, that's what hunting is. Hunting is not a war that you wage on animals. Hunting is this kind of conversation and back and forth that the non-human animal community has with the human animal community. It's the reminder that we are all participants in this landscape. All right. I want there to be time for conversation. I think you guys said enough about what I'm just speaking about. Is that right?
Yeah, this is great. So I think what we hope to do, we kind of went back and forth about whether we should break into groups or not, and I don't know if you guys feel strongly about that.
but I think we could probably still do it. So what we would like to do now is just open up a conversation about your own experience with skill and craft, whether individually or in community, and then if you have questions for us, we're happy to take them, and if you have suggestions, I think this would be a good time too. Yeah, and maybe, so I don't know everybody's name, so if you just say your name, and we'll go from there.
My name is Dale Burgess. I have a question and a story
that
relates to that. The title of this workshop is Crafting as Discipleship. And so discipleship implies bringing others into the activity.
Right.
And yet soap making and bow making I see as being primarily individual activities. You can't really go down to the local park and create soap.
So I invite people to come and do these things with me as a way to teach them to do it, and then I encourage them to teach others. So as a pedagogical activity, it certainly is communal, but I can see how, I mean, plenty of people make soap by themselves.
Well, the story is that part of my, I have a rather broad background in crafting in lots of different fashions, and fiber crafts became a very integral part of my life for a decade or so. In the process of doing that, I learned how to tack. And when I spent 3 months in Los Angeles area, I had to fly back and forth, and so for the hour between flights in the airports, I would be sitting in a chair tatting. For people who are not familiar with it, I've always referred to it as the manly art of lace making. It uses a little shuttle full of yarn, and it's what was used to make decorative edgings for different materials. Inevitably, at any airport that I was doing this, within 10 minutes, I would have somebody come up to me
right. And
say, excuse me, but what are you doing?
Right.
And I'd say, this is 10. It's like, without exception, it was always, well, I remember my grandmother doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you, is there a way that you would suggest that we move our workshop into a more public space?
Well, so, I mean, just on the grandmother and manly aspect, I mean, I make lotion and soap, you know, but I also make bikes, and everybody needs a bicycle and soap, if you ask me. And I think they need both equally.
One after the other, right?
Although I think Tyler has more bikes than soap.
That's true.
But in terms of bringing these things into the public space, one of the things that's been on my mind with the two plenaries thus far has been how am I going to turn the screws on my congregation, right? How am I going to get them involved in this stuff? And I'm in a congregation where everything is committee, listening campaigns, and not a lot of doing. And so for me, getting it into the public space first means inviting people into my living room or my kitchen or my basement or my backyard, or coming and doing something like this. But I think sometimes preaching requires hospitality first, and then you can be in the public square setting.
I think everybody brings to the community the gifts that they've been given. And so I don't think community necessarily means everybody's doing the same thing, but people bring different things. There aren't many donators. But actually, I did get them to set up an armory room. And it gets limited use mostly on weekends. It's more of the shooting than the bow making, but it's something I have to offer.
One of the things I was thinking about is the Montessori faith religious education that I do at my parish, which is very, it's called Catechism of the Good Shepherd, and it's very, and I talk about it in previous gatherings too, but one of the things that I find about it it was one of my first encounters with craft. Because it's very formation based. It's very much like you can't go out and buy books. You can't go out and buy material. You can't do the traditional kind of Sunday school stuff that often happens with this sort of catechism. You have to go and take, it's called a formation class. You have to go and be in 90 hours of formation with other people who have done this for years. And you learn how to make things, right? And one of the things that has been part of this process for me is I've started two, they're called atrium at my parish. One is for 3 to 6 year olds and the other is for 6 to 9 year olds. And it's been kind of a crazy lot of work. But one of the things that I learned about it is, you know, I had to rely on the Christian community to provide a lot of things for it. So, for instance, Tyler made a prayer table for one of the rooms. And people would bring in, I would list things in the bulletin every week and say, hey, we need, old baskets to hold stuff in. And people would bring, people have baskets everywhere, right? People would bring baskets in. And we needed someone to do some sewing, and someone did sewing, right? And so, like, all these things were either handmade or found pieces that, ended up being, and it kind of, I really liked that. I liked the way that it formed me to be very patient, because there's a lot of times where I'm like, I wish I could just go buy this thing and just have it. And that's not the key. I mean, one of the instances I'm thinking about is this humongous table that we have that was built by someone at work that has on it different three-dimensional wood pieces of the city of Jerusalem. It was meant to be an institution for children to learn about the last few days of Jesus' life in Jerusalem during Holy Week. And it's been 4 years and still not quite finished. It's usable for the children, but, I keep going, maybe next year we'll have it, So it's this constant process. I do think that there's a kind of virtue in that, and like always having to be formed by that. And I guess I just wanted to mention that as a sort of extended example of the way that craft can be very much a part of, I think, the local community.
Well, I think doing craft in community erases the private-public distinction, especially in the context of hospitality. So you're inviting people into your home, and that space becomes something not really private, but not really public either. So like in the case of the atrium, you're dependent upon a body of people to supply your needs, and really, if they don't show up, you can't continue. Like, if there's a cost, again, it's totally not sexy.
Yeah, I guess the more I heard you guys talking about craft, skill, like using those words, I think one thing I kept thinking about was how to use existing skills. You just touched on that with the last thing you said, with how to disciple or to bless the body that you're a part of. But I think for me, I'm part of a small community who has a very high number of people that either currently attend, work at, or graduated from Christian college, and I'm one of very few who have no connection with that Christian college, and I'm a mental health therapist, and I work with foster children, so it's very different than, the biblical theology of, academics, and I think it was very liberating for me when I realized that although my craft isn't necessarily creation care focused, it was very liberating when I realized how much I could use my skill to bless the people of my body. And just, helping a family in our church adopt a child through foster care, and being a part of families who are struggling with difficult children, however I can use that. And just, I think that using your existing skills to be able to, help your current body and pretty amazing experience too. So I'm just, I'm listening to the way that I can just imagine how it feels to build a bike with someone or see that bike go down the road. When I see a child that I helped that's doing better, or, you know, when I see this family that's adopted a child, it's really cool.
Mm-hmm. I would hope that helping kids do better can be part of our definition for creation.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks for that.
Yeah, I think going off of this, relating to the first preacher and a few things I've said here, one critical aspect to be able to be good at a craft, as you call it, a craft person, is limiting what you try to do for the number of things you do. And as the first preacher talked about, not trying to do everything, and you have to notice this in your sort of an academic and assuming that we can. I get overly enthusiastic and think I can't do it. Yeah, I can figure everything out.
Right.
But relating to doing what you do well, being okay with that limitation, mm-hmm. and taking the time to get it. One kind of story example of this is we recently also bought a fairly house mm-hmm. in D.C. And my dad's a carpenter. I grew up in carpentry. My first example, this is still a little quote rack in our laundry that had my 4-year-old scrawl Nathan's coat rack with little nails knocked into it. But my brother is an artist. He's very good at a lot of patience and does fabulous work. And we wanted a big bookshelf, and he was a soccer enough to agree to make bookshelves for us for Christmas. And he used walnut wood that my dad had harvested mm-hmm. back in the 70s from like my grandparents' meadow that's been sitting in a barn drying since then.
Wow.
And he made these. Pre-made all the pieces for me, and then from that night, finished them and put them all together. But that, if my dad, my brother had tried to do everything in the world,
right,
they would not have had the space for to have this one sitting in the barn for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, this probably goes back to people buying more books than what they actually do.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tendency to get excited about soap making or cutting making. Do everything. It sounds
sure.
It sounds fabulous.
And that's totally my affliction, actually. It's taking them on, doing them, not taking them on and petering out, just having a bunch of books. And I actually tend to search this on the internet more than buying books, anyways. I have enough academic books that I don't buy others. That lust has been satisfied, or rather, it's being satisfied. But, I totally agree. As an artist, limitations are really important to me. Like, as a musician, like, choosing a limitation when you're in a recording studio, that's so as an aesthetic principle. But as a college professor, right, who has students who, for instance, never made a mixtape, right, who their primary experience of furniture is IKEA, right, there's the simulacrum of making. But really not. My greater concern is just to convince them that they can make something,
right?
And even to open up that imaginative space of what making something is, right? Most of my students don't feel this void, right? They don't think that they don't make anything. They don't think about making things. So, while in principle I agree with you, I would that I had college students who had 2 DIY projects, right? Who would stretch then? And then we can begin dealing with that formative problem, right? And then, for me, the greater hurdle is the initial one, and that is just think about making something. This is the Matthew Crawford book that's floating around the room. This is largely his concern is that we are a frustrated humanity, but we don't know it. Because our primary engagement with the material world is, automated faucets and cars that we throw away and the story, right?
I think just another little piece of that, I think there is a subtle distinction between craft and DIY, or at least a helpful one in thinking. So that there's something to be said about DIY in the sense of there's a project that needs to be done and realizing the human capacity to actually fix it, just fix the problem, be able to go in and maybe do it really messy. And then there's the other side of it, of like choosing the things that you hone.
Right.
So like hopefully over time, my love for woodworking kind of continues to grow and I continue to learn wood, look at trees and understand how they are related to the environment.
very helpful.
So that like having, knowing the capacity to recognize a need and have not the first thought in your mind be, I will just go buy it. I need a shelf. Well, I'll just, they have cheap ones. I'll just look at that. But to actually say, well, I'm just going to build it. It's not going to be that pretty. Or maybe it will be.
So we have a few hands. Yeah, right. So this one, the two of you, all of you get up.
On that thought of you know, let your first thought not be, let me go buy it, but
right.
At least think about making it. My problem is I have a lot of ideas. I'm like, ooh, I could try to make this, and I can, like, but I am aware enough that I don't have the skills, and so that paralyzes me from taking the action. How do you leap from the realm of the intellectual to the realm of, you know, it's going to be ugly, but at least I'll make it, and it'll be functional. And then, I'm stuck in that frame. So how did, when you guys were first getting into the things you're in, how did you make that leap?
It was, you know, total roll of the dice. It was, for me, with, like, especially with the bike, it was, I just needed a bike, and then the bike needed to be repaired, and then I bumped into this guy at a coffee shop. With beer brewing, it was, and cheers, everybody. And if somebody didn't get one or didn't get enough, there's a little bit left.
There's one extra over here.
It is. With the beer brewing, it was, you know, a couple of the graduate students in my master's program were talking about it, and I had been thinking about it, and so it just seemed like a great opportunity to have community. So with do-it-yourself stuff around the house, it's all about which of my neighbors I can tap into.
That may be the public aspect that was noted earlier. Even if we think of it in terms of having an asset and giving to someone, but also being kind of going out of your way to get to know someone who can teach, which might be the sort of reverse of what we're trying to think of being humble.
Yeah, I think you should shamelessly ask for help. I do.
This is one of the theses of Crawford's book, too, which is that in an ironic sort of way, we lack agency. We lack the sense that we can do things. And the advantage of working in a shop as opposed to as an academic mm-hmm. is you've got a real sense of agency, and, which means you can really screw things up, right? Mm-hmm. And you're responsible and you're held accountable. Mm-hmm. Whereas in academia, you know, if you really screw things up, probably nobody gets hurt, and probably nobody's held accountable, right? Yeah. So,
it's a little
right. Finding a mentor and just trying to get it.
Just very quick, there's that tension a little bit. Maybe it's a creative tension that you just don't want to go away, and I think that's probably the case. But with some of the craft or DIY stuff, there's that sense, and you said it, I'm trying to get off the grid, you know.
Right.
And I think you said that, and you mean that in a certain sense, mm-hmm. but I think you probably care more about the agency and the ways is it about separation?
Well, I'm not trying to get off the social grid.
Right, no, I know. There's a sense that it's about DIY and craft is about separation, but there's also a sense that it's about connection to that is connecting you to others, etc. And we all have this. I mean, human formation and development goes from dependence to independence to sort of a healthy interdependence. If we ever are to mature, we do that as sort of persons. We do that as communities. We do that as city economies. I love, and our time is short here, but it would be great for us to continue to think on why are we engaged in some of these things. And a lot of it is just about agency. It's about just being able to create as the Creator has given us those desires. But I do think there is that almost like a bow. You kind of got that. You need the tension mm-hmm. in a bow of just sort of the I can do this myself, but it's also I need to be connected to others for things to be truly interdependent.
With a hand in the back and a hand in the front, and we're getting close.
I'm glad you brought up music, because that's my craft. I'm a singer-songwriter, and I've been in bands over the years, and now I do kind of more solo stuff and recording. And I, the first time I heard the term DIY was when I was about 14, learned to play guitar, and my punk rock ultra server friend
yes.
introduced me to Fugazi. He gave me a Fugazi tape. And you know, I was a big REM fan. I was kind of getting into alternative music, but then Fugazi blew my mind with just how DIY they were.
K-pop.
Hmm?
K-pop. The scene, K-pop.
Yeah.
It's all about DIY recording.
Yeah. But just, yeah, that as a young person, having that sense of agency and like I can make something and I don't have to just take what's force fed to me in the culture.
That's right.
I was catechized about discipleship by punk rock and a lot of it. And started bands and stuff. And still do that. And you know, learn different instruments. But it kind of brings up I've done some thinking about this theologically and I've done some writing on it, and I'm trying to think about the practice of songwriting and theology and prayer and how that all fits together. But thinking back over my time and hearing some stuff that you said, is that there's different versions of DIY, or like different approaches to it. And like, probably all of us know somebody who's a musician who has home recording gear and they're trying to make it as a musician. And there's all this technology. When I was starting, we had cassette tapes and silk screen covers, and we had maybe a cassette 4-track, but we didn't have computers to record with, or CD burners weren't invented yet. You know, it's a lot easier to make music now, and it's a lot easier to get your product out there as a musician, and that's considered DIY by a lot of people,
right?
But it's kind of reproducing a certain model of thinking about music, whereas I think when certain people who have been involved in punk rock get older, and they're trying to be, you know, have the DIY values kind of seep into the rest of their life, like in their politics and the other kinds of crafts that you've been talking about. The community part plays a bigger role in music as well. So I'm still a singer-songwriter, but it's less about creating an online presence with a product. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to do the same thing that, you know, famous songwriters do, but I'm just going to do it myself. Mm-hmm. And get it out there, but it becomes more about do it ourselves and the kind of context in which I make the music and who I make music for and why. The kinds of shows that I play, if they're even called shows, if it's just sitting around at a house. Yeah, one of the first things that happened when I got here this weekend was I got reacquainted with Tom up here. He came up to me and said, you're Michael Eifert, right? And I said, yeah, have we met before? He said, yeah, he used to live in Morgantown, West Virginia, which is where I live, and they lived in a Bruderhof community house, which I was introduced to through a mutual friend, and we had guitars sitting around, and we were all singing and playing music together, and he remembered a song that I played, and, you know, and just that kind of stuff becomes more important as you, you know, you discover I can create something, I can do this myself. But what it becomes less about this activity that I can market as an artisan or whatever, but it becomes about how I connect with people and bring people together and letting that craft kind of seep into the whole of your life and other people's lives. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of stuff I think about. I guess my theology of DIY is kind of in that place now.
Yeah, I think I was just thinking through a lot of stuff that I've already just kind of been thinking about and focusing on and kind of meditating on. And the trouble of DIY becoming a hobby for, you know, upper middle class people who have time on their hands to do something fun. And the whole nature of craft as virtue, character development, and also community development. And what I really am thinking is letting DIY or craft building or crafting be a kind of a reintroduction to a completely different way of life. Like, for instance, crafting doesn't have to be, or at least what we're talking about now, doesn't have to be about bow making or shelf making or bike making or beer making, but people who have their everyday crafts like nursing, mm-hmm. or you know, doctors and lawyers, or what are some other things that people do? You know, I mean, custodians or whatever somebody's passion is, or at least they're really good at and they make money at it. Mm-hmm. Instead of making money and going to a job where they're constantly trying to better themselves because they're putting more money in the bank so they can come home and buy things.
Right.
Learning to live in a community where we learn what it is that we're good at and take advantage of that.
Right.
You know, so that if a kid breaks his arm, he doesn't, you know, parents don't first think about going to the hospital and paying a big hospital bill, but know somebody in the church community and say, I'm going to call a nurse. Yeah, and get friends that can come over. And, I mean, you can buy all the materials you need to doctor a broken arm.
Right.
You know, you don't have to go to a hospital. Maybe you do. but my point is learning to learn. But we can explore those kinds of things.
Sure. Right.
Learning to take advantage of what we're really good at rather than relying on these little economies that were all around us full of people who spend money.
What would it be like if church directory both listed them? The person's craft.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then they're going to take advantage of that.
Right. It sounds like it's just the beginning of a really rich conversation, so I encourage you to find folks. I'm sure they'll hang out up front too if you want to talk more.
Yeah.
Lunch is in the cafeteria. The afternoon sessions are back here, and why don't we go ahead and show our appreciation for
the